Today, we're going to talk about gentrification, transportation, urban planning, rent control, and what it all means for the working class, who are often the ones impacted most. We've got two great guests on board to help us out today. This is the Lowrider Samurai Podcast. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Lowrider Samurai. Here's your host, Brandon Lauren Maxwell.
My guest today is a professor in the Department of Chicana and Chicano Studies at California State University, Fullerton. He has a PhD in urban and regional planning. He specializes in community development, neighborhood planning, planning and health, and urban governance. He is also the author of the book, Latino City, Urban Planning, Politics, and the Grassroots. His name is Araldo Gonzalez, and with him is Kimberly Miranda, who is currently a doctoral student researching gentrification. Araldo, Kimberly, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
So before we dive too deep into gentrification, perhaps you can give our audience a rough definition of just exactly what gentrification is.
So I think the actual term, it gets tied to a British sociologist, Ruth Glass. So this goes back to the 60s, and she had some observations out in inner London. And so I want to read a quote, and this is important. She says, "One by one, many of the working class quarters of London have been invaded by the middle classes, upper and lower. Shabby, modest mews and cottages, two rooms up and two down, have been taken over when their leases have expired and have become elegant, expensive residences. Larger Victorian houses, downgraded in an earlier or recent period, which were used as lodging houses or were otherwise in multiple occupations, have been upgraded once again. Once this process of gentrification, quote-unquote, starts in a district, it goes on rapidly until all or most of the original working-class occupiers are displaced and the whole social character of the district is changed." So that is really important, and what I want to really point out from there for those that are listening is her use of the word invaded and her concern with the working class, and those, and where this invasion is coming from, right? She points out middle class populations. And one of the things that's not pointed out there is that she's really talking about also immigrant communities, but doesn't talk about it. But really focuses on the class dimension and the invasion dimension.
That's interesting. Go ahead, Kimberly.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's important, right? And I think nowadays we kind of see gentrification, and this is kind of language that I'm borrowing from some activists, that, like, you know, is forced migration from a community that, you know, you grew up in and you lived in, and, you know, speculative forces kind of come in and start buying out a lot of the local mom and pop shops and a lot of the locally owned apartments, and it becomes a lot more corporate.
So in looking back at the classic definition, so at that point, was it working class people being pushed out by middle class, or middle class being pushed out by upper class?
Like, in the definition, it says working class being pushed out by the middle class.
Okay.
But in the middle class, it says upper and lower. So she offers a fine tune. It's not just middle class. There's a lower middle class and there's an upper middle class. But at the end of the day, it's middle class. And the concern is the working class. So I want to now kind of bring forth a definition of gentrification, and it borrows from a lot of different theorists, and I'll obviously let you know who they are. But it's the natural transformation of the working class, housing, commercial, or vacant area of a city into significant amounts of middle class residential commercial use via displacement and remodeling of new development and infrastructure improvements. The social character of the area changes significantly as well. And so a lot of that thinking there borrows from, obviously, Glass. You see some of the language from Glass. Tom Slater, Peter Marcuse, other theorists of gentrification are included in that definition. I add a natural element to it because it's large-scale gentrification is not inevitable. It's human-made and it's tied to public policy. That is so important. And what we also have to discuss is how outside forces out of the control of working class and working poor households, you know, are contributing to the displacement. So we have to look at macroeconomic and urban elite forces who are making, to cite Marcuse, who says, living, operating, or claiming rights in an area, quote, impossible, hazardous, or unaffordable, unquote. So it's bigger picture realities that are going on. So it's not just looking at these individual level, oh, well, people want to buy a house or people can't afford it or they were displaced. That is part of it. But there's a bigger picture here that we have to pay attention to. For example, you also have to think about, well, what is creating this impossibility? What is it making? What is making things unaffordable? And so that is so important. And one of the things that I like to think about is, okay, there's housing, and then there's also the business element.
You know, when you talk about outside forces coming in, I think about, so Boyle Heights and East LA have been having this issue where you're having outside investors, basically developers, who are already buying up properties in anticipation of building on those properties at some point in the future. And the result of that is you get people who can't move into properties, for one, because they just sit empty. And two, you get development of those areas that might not fit the character of those areas. So when you look at somewhere like Inglewood, for example, where they have the new stadium that they're building, and there's a lot of people getting pushed out, would that fall under the classification of gentrification?
Kimberly, do you want to speak to that?
I mean, yeah, I would definitely still categorize it under gentrification. And I mean, Inglewood, too, is so interesting because it's one of the first few cities that just passed rent control as well. So we're kind of seeing like these kind of like forces or ordinances for tenants, you know, to have stronger protections, right? Because of, you know, bigger development projects kind of happening, like the stadium, you know, and it's all kind of interconnected too, to, you know, like the Olympics coming in soon. So it's also like this push to kind of like quote unquote beautify or kind of like fix the city for that, I feel. You know, and in Boyle Heights too, we have the case of the quote unquote mail order district that's now, you know, it's been bought, the building has been bought, and it's, you know, going to be like this high rise luxury, a place, you know, that has like retail for like new businesses for the creative class. And yeah, we kind of definitely see these different forces that might not look the same in cities, in all cities across LA, but definitely have the same impact of, you know, rent increasing, of folks kind of like being bought out, and everything like that.
Again, looking at the bigger picture, how does it happen? And so you really start to look at some of the examples that you laid out, Brandon, in terms of speculation, buying up housing stock, waiting for real estate trends to shift. And then you also have to look at the revitalization efforts that go down a lot of downtowns, where in the last 40 years, a lot of places have been disinvested, and now those are really closely tied to a lot of redevelopment. So you see a lot of redevelopment, especially in the downtown core areas within about 2 to 3 miles from that. And there's a lot of similar models that go on, like work, live, work, loss, redevelopment. You see a lot of more focused on transit-oriented development, where you want people to get off their cars, walk more, get on the train. So you see a lot of common patterns of how redevelopment is happening and where it's happening. And there are different models. So you have new urbanist redevelopment focused on design. Again, the work-live-loss is the traditional one that you start to see in a lot of places around the world. And Kimberly mentioned the creative class. So you see a lot of attention to more the programming and economic development. So you have people who are the artists who are encouraged to be in these spaces. And then eventually a lot of them, are you're starting to see, are they themselves are priced out and not even able to live where they were first invited or were living. to bring in this cool vibe of the downtowns, correct? And then you have economies where people who are software game developers or people who work with their brains to create and innovate, that's part of the working class. And so you have a lot of a menu for gentrification, if you will, that you really need to see all over the world.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I didn't even think about the fact that the impact that, like, transportation development, for example, could have.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct, because if you look at a lot of the downtown areas, for example, we want to focus here in the United States, that's part of the development vision. You need to have new or improved transit. And so, like in Santana, for example, part of that discussion is the trolley. And so when you think about this transit, you think, okay, what is it going to do? Do you have to buy up through eminent domain housing to create new transit or improve transit, if you will?
Mm-hmm.
And then so it has a lot of normative, meaning positive elements to it. Of course, you want to discourage people in cars. You want to reduce pollution. You want to encourage people to walk, which is a good public health angle. Why wouldn't you want that? You want to reduce people being in their cars. You want them to be at home. You want them to socialize with their neighbors. That you can't really go against that. But the bigger picture is, what's the vision? Who is the transit for? What are you getting rid of to accommodate this new transit vision? Who will be the people who are going to be taking advantage of this transit to go to what type of jobs?
Right.
For people who have more of a higher income, these need. And so you have to think about that. And at the end of the day, you go back to Ruth's vision and preoccupation is, well, the people who are mostly going to be left out and screwed are the working class communities that can't fend for themselves, who are what Marcuse calls the materially deprived. Right? And so that's the concern. No one's going to refute that a lot of these things are not beautiful.
Now, Kimberly, I know that you are going to have to leave us in 10 minutes or so, but did you want to add anything to what he just said?
Yeah, and I mean, I think it also forces, I mean, as it is, I think a lot of vulnerable tenants, you know, tenants that are either rent burdened or severely rent burdened, meaning like they pay over 30% of their income on rent or over 50% of their income on rent, you know, they're already kind of like facing this very restrictive housing market that, you know, is no longer being owned by mom and pop shops anymore. Like, these are now corporate landlords. So I think, you know, also bringing the conversation back to like, who is owning this property now? Like, who are we renting to? And like, what do those regulations look like? And given my work is on rent control right now. So I'm really looking at how, you know, this has helped, you know, some type of financial burden for a lot of tenants that have to navigate, you know, kind of looking around. And as it is, it's already kind of disappearing in terms of, like, you know, landlords that are going to, like, you know, let big families, you know, stay at apartments. Now it's becoming a lot more restrictive where they don't allow more than 3 people, you know, to stay at one place and things like that. So it's also, you know, for me, I also see it as, like, what Ananya Roy calls as, like, racial banishment, you know?
Yeah.
Like, people are banishing from the city because they can no longer afford or, like, you know, the rent. And, again, going back to Eduardo's kind of case, that, you know, these amenities, like, aren't for them anymore.
Going back to what you were saying earlier, a really good example of that, in Portland, I grew up in a Mexican-American community in the suburbs of Portland. And there was, so Portland already has not a lot of black neighborhoods. And they had a kind of an area that had begun to develop and organically come to life. And you had some businesses over there that were predominantly black. And the city came in and they said, you know what would be beautiful in front of these businesses is a bike path. And so, of course, the city is ran by predominantly white people, and they thought it was a great idea. But what's interesting is they never once talked to the businesses about maybe what they needed. So they went ahead and they built the bike paths. But what they did when building the bike paths is they got rid of all the parking in front of the businesses. And as a result, customers no longer had an easy access to the businesses, and all of the businesses went out of business. So here, trying to push this, you know, the bike paths, and they didn't ask, you know, them. They never got their input on anything. They just, bike paths are good. That's the idea. and they got rid of all their parking. And I feel like that's a good example of what you were talking about earlier. Unintended consequences.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. It really depends. What is an unintended consequence and what is an intended consequence? Okay, and that's what we have to be very critical, depending on on the city, the neighborhood, the urban elite, stakeholders, city council, urban developers who are working together. Is it an unintended consequence? That's a good question to have. Mm. Or are some of these things intended? We know that by putting a bike lane, there's a bigger vision. What's the bike lane for? Were you planning for these consumers of these businesses to ride a bike to go purchase from these businesses? Or did you have a vision 10 years from now that you know it's going to take time to reconfigure a different consumer base? Who is going to want to ride their bikes? Who has the leisure to do that? And who hopefully is now patronizing different types of businesses? So I don't know. I don't know the context there, but yeah. I'm always wondering what is intended and what is unintended. And I think that's so what true. Urban planning is all about. You know, when we look at revitalization plans, when you look at these strategic plans that you start to see up, what do these sketches look like? Who are these people there? What are the narratives in those documents? And who's there and who isn't? I'm curious to learn more about that case, Brandon. But you're right in terms of that's urban planning. Hmm. You know, that was a strategic decision to do that. And it has, in many respects, I'm sure, a positive element. You want people to be on their bikes. You want healthy people. But there are other questions to ask there. And that's what makes a lot of this very nuanced and complicated in some respects.
Kimberly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes me think of a lot of the Metro bike share, at least that I've been seeing around LA. And I know there was a lot of pushback from community folks in Boyle Heights when, you know, I'm not sure if it ended up coming through or not, but when there was talks around having Metro bike share, around having small stations for people to come and ride their bikes. And, you know, again, that is very... it comes with like these notions of being voyeuristic, right, as well. And yeah, kind of going back to Eduardo's case on, you know, like who has the time to ride their bike, you know, to what businesses, but also like price, you know, it costs money, you know, to rent those bikes out and stuff. So
do you think that so urban planning and those boards sometimes that make those decisions, do you think that those processes could be improved by shaking up the ethnic makeup of those boards? Or do you think that that wouldn't fix the problem?
You have a great question.
That's a good question.
You know, that's one of the things I'm fascinated with. And there isn't a lot of, if we're looking at the literature, one of the question that you come up with, there's a book called Latino Mayors, by Marion Orr and Domingo Morel in 2017, Temple University Press, or is that of Brown University and Domingo Morel is that of Rutgers. And they have an edited book, and they speak to your question, where they look at Latino mayors it's an edited book which has about 7 case studies there, and they take different cities throughout the United States, and they look at the question of Latino mayors. And at the end of the day, they do ask the question in terms of, through all these case studies, at the end of the day, does the Latino representation in these communities matter? The bottom line, if you look at all these case studies, is that a lot of the mayors look for your traditional upgrades for middle class, and it doesn't really address working class communities. Not to say that all Latinos communities, let me backtrack. Not to say that all Latino mayors are in heavy represented Latino communities, but at the end of the day, if you're asking would a Latino or Latina, Latinx elected official be concerned for working class interests, I think that's the question. The jury's still out, and if you rephrase it in that sense, these case studies will say no, that's not really the case. And then they offer different reasons. Mm-hmm. They're all context specific, but at the end of the day, the answer would be through the evidence, you still have a lot of the gentrification dominating in a lot of these places.
Yeah, a piece of me would think that it would also have to do with the class that they came from. So I don't know if that's true. That's just speculation. But, you know, and not only that, but how many would it take? I mean, you're still going to have some of these boards. You have some pretty big boards, and a lot of people have been on there a lot of times. So, yeah, I'd be curious to know what those variables are, but I know that's a separate conversation. So I guess going back to to urban planning then, which is, you know, it's an interesting concept to me. It's something I hear a lot about. And it's also one of those things that sometimes takes party lines. And I generally try to stay away from party lines because I think that there are some bad things that come from both sides that we tend to overlook. And urban planning is one of them. You know, a lot of people talk about urban planning as a really positive thing, and perhaps it can be, but not without ill side effects at times. So my question to you is, if we know that we haven't seen these things be mitigated through increasing the ethnic makeup of some of these boards and urban planners, what is something that can be done to, I think, benefit neighborhoods in a positive way through urban planning? Or is it just stepping back and not getting involved at all?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I mean, I think it's tricky, right? Because in one sense, like, we do need development, but it needs to be accountable to the community that it's going to be in. So that comes with a lot of transparency. There needs to be a lot of communication that sometimes, you know, doesn't happen, right? Accessibility as well. So I think, yeah, I think we're still in the works of that and trying to figure that out. But kind of something that comes to mind, you know, kind of going back to this whole rent control idea that was really, like, started by a tenant in East LA, and I'm talking about LA County now. You know, there was a lot of community folks trying to have or having input on what that means for them and what they wanted, right? Like, they didn't want any of these loopholes. They made sure to constantly go to the board of supervisors and tell them, like, hey, like, make sure you pass this, but if you pass it, make sure that, like, it's not going to screw us over in the end, you know? And those things are tricky, right? It's politics, and sometimes there's just no way around it, but it's just really pretty much holding whoever's in power or whoever is making these decisions accountable, and however that might look like, you know, I think differs in different areas. But I think that's something that I know has been in the works and has people have been trying to figure out what that means. But definitely, I think just more communication between, you know, where you're going to build and who the developer or what that force is.
Maybe your listeners may be interested. The Urban Displacement Project, there's a collaboration with UC Berkeley and UCLA and others. They put together a pretty good list of policy ideas that a lot of communities, a number of communities throughout the United States are crafting and working with. So, for example, these are all have to do with policies. So there's just cost evictions, rent control, stabilization, density bonus ordinances, community land trust. There are specific policy ideas that neighborhoods and activists are trying to use either to stop or curtail gentrification. Okay. The extent that they're successful, that's another question, and it really varies. I don't think you're going to open up a book or an article or have an interview with anyone that will say, look, you have 5 case studies. This is a successful gentrification project. Because when you say gentrification, the definition, again, it's you are diminishing, getting rid of, or displacing a working class community in favor of middle class communities. If you're middle class, maybe for you, displacing a working class and having the privileges and being in those spaces as a consumer or resident, maybe that is good for you. So you might say that is great, that's successful. But if you're using gentrification, that already has an inherent viewpoint and an inherent perspective and moral view that type of planning and what you're seeing is not right. And so that's why you have these type of policies to say, look what's happening. We want to reverse it or stop it. And so I encourage the listeners, you know, the Urban Displacement Project is probably the only website, the project that has a website that really does a good job in putting these different types of policy mechanisms that communities are trying to use for anti-gentrification.
Now, if rent control is passed in an area and developers move into the area and, for example, develop a new building, does that mean that those new buildings can't go past what that limit is, or does that only apply to current buildings in the surrounding areas that may be affected?
Yeah, it depends where the jurisdiction is. So it also depends what year the building was constructed. So there are kind of like a few of these kind of like regulations that it has to fall under for you to benefit under rent control. But yeah, I mean, for example, like if the building for whatever reason was bought off by a corporate landlord, like now the landlord is very limited to, you know, eviction or to, pretty much like evicting whoever's there. So it buys, you know, tenants time, and as well with rent increases, right? So depending on the area, whether it's 3% to 6%, which sometimes is still a lot,
mm-hmm.
You know, is still somehow able to help the tenant kind of like maneuver. But yeah, it's definitely kind of been coming up a lot where, you know, these are now like resources that tenants are fighting for, right, to stay here in LA or wherever community they're coming from.
So sometimes with rent control, you can still have rent increases, just not as much as it might be without rent control, you're saying?
Yes. So, yeah. So, for example, like LA County just passed it, and it would say it's 3%. So 3% is like for every $1,000 you pay, it's like $30, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice. It's like once a year. But then you have places like Inglewood. I'm not sure if it's like 6 or 8%. And that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know? That's like, you know, going to like the $100. So it varies from location.
Do you know if different forms of rent control have been tried and some have been more successful than others? I know that I read a paper once on rent control in New York City, and what happened was the owners of the apartment buildings, because they knew they could no longer raise rent, they just stopped doing upkeep on the apartment buildings. Like they felt they didn't have an incentive to keep upkeeping the building. So the tenants lived in this building and slowly got degraded over time. Has that been an issue that's continued, or is that something that can be rectified also through policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely varies. I think you definitely have landlords out there that are very negligent and, you know, kind of maybe use this, right, to be antagonistic because they can no longer raise your rent. And I've seen these cases with some of the tenants that I spoke to in unincorporated East LA that, one, you know, didn't understand what rent control was. And because LA County has never had rent control, like, you know, it was non-existent to, you know, what these benefits could be. But I know at least in that case, like, if it's kind of like a fix in your apartment that is like, I don't want to say life-threatening, but if it does, like, kind of impact health, like, it is illegal, right? Like, for that reason, then your landlord cannot even raise your rent, even within the rent control increase. So I'm not sure what the regulations are in New York, but at least I know here, like, you know, if it's, like, mold, if it's, like, something very detrimental like that and it's not fixed, like, then, you know, you cannot get your rent raised until those things are attended to.
One of the things Brandon also wanted to bring to attention, so for example, a lot of the, for example, rent control, you know, that's the housing element. Another part that I wanted to also highlight and make sure we put part of this discussion is the commercial aspect, because they go hand in hand. There's the master narratives. There are visionaries that want to gentrify, and we're seeing it. And so housing is our livelihood. Housing is, should be our number one concern. The commercial aspect too also is right there, right next door. And I wanted to bring this up because, as an example, in Boston, there are a group of commercial tenants who have been voicing that there aren't any anti-displacement protections that you tend to hear about, or at least folks try to work towards, as in housing. Because so one of the things is, for example, could we or should we be thinking about the commercial livelihood of businesses? should we be thinking about those consumers who are working class that patronize particular types of businesses that are affordable to them?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just the market forces that are happening out there that just start to change the businesses because that's just the evolution of consumerism and the production of downtown corridors, right? So the point is, should we start thinking about similar policy mechanisms of downtown areas that have been historically disinvested, where a lot of working class communities wrap their lives around as consumers and as small businesses? What kind of protections do we have for them?
Right. I'm gonna have to jump in real quick and I have to head out. But thank you so much, Brandon, for facilitating this conversation. I think it's very important, and we should all take a part of it. Right. It's happening all around. So thank you for having us.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Thank you for joining us, Kimberly, and thank you for offering us some of your insight. Do you have a social media handle or anything that people can reach you at if they're interested in following some of your work?
I do not at the moment, but any further questions or anything that folks might want to further talk about or are interested in, they can reach me by email on kimmiranda214@gmail.com.
Great. Thank you. So I kind of lost my train of thought there. Commercial businesses.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about, I've read some stuff lately about a lot of the small businesses, for example, getting pushed out of Highland Park, that a lot of the neighborhood is really fond of, that had been there for 40, 50 years in some examples, that just were pushed out. And I think that kind of goes to a broader topic, which I think that is probably something that's more evident for a lot of people who don't understand the ins and outs or the politics and policies of gentrification, which is the cultural shifts, right? Because sometimes those tend to be a little bit more visible.
No, I'm not too sure how much of a issue it is or how prevalent it is, but you're probably familiar with the whole term of gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure or some of us. And really, it's just a spin on to say, well, we have middle-class Latinos who are, and it's really focused on the commercial aspect, opening up businesses that are targeting middle-class and, younger generations, but really it's a middle-class pocket. And it's seen as a celebration, as a good way to give back to the community, right? Kind of the upward mobility that is a positive thing, where you have generations of activists and we want to pursue higher education, have access to resources, and you want upward mobility.
Mm-hmm.
We fight for that. And so now you have upward mobility, where you have some Latino business owners opening up businesses that are part of the gentrification process. But they provide amenities that in some respects will have kind of a cultural element to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question becomes, is that okay?
Right.
Is gentrification a good thing?
Yeah.
We are investing in community. And that is a tension that you see in some spaces right now.
Yeah, chipsters, I think, is the derogatory term for a lot of people who might do that. I think that's a really interesting debate. I that's something I hear a lot about, even from my own friends. And there's so I've always been involved with the car community, particularly the lowrider community. And I grew up lowriding, and my first car was 67 Impala. And I follow that a lot.
Nice.
And
my dad had a 67 Impala.
Oh, nice. I've been saving up for a new Impala, and we'll see when I get there. I was supposed to buy a 65 months ago, and the guy backed out of selling it to me, so we'll see what happens. So the car culture in LA shifted a little bit, and it used to be spread out across you could go on the west side or the east side, and there's a documentary that's being made right now. It's actually being in part funded by Danny Trejo, and it's about some of the cultural shift that's happened as a result of development that you're seeing in Venice Beach and those areas that have pushed out some of the car shops and things like that. And some of the low riding community a lot of aspects that are associated with Chicano culture. And I think that's really fascinating because you can go somewhere like Instagram, or you can even go down to different shops and stuff, and you see this new generation that loves to talk about that culture, right? They all want to take pictures when the cars come. Okay. They want to take selfies with them. They want to have T-shirts mm-hmm. made, and they want to pose like we used to in the 90s. But none of them are actually doing anything to keep it alive. And and they're all their business interests are all somewhere else, and I think that's fascinating.
That's you got me thinking here. That is a very specific example of you're right. So, what about if these car shops that were once there have been replaced by new car shops that make low riding even another high end level? I don't know if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And they are now going to open up the low riding experience and whatever it is selling or renovating to this consumer group that you're talking about that doesn't want to really invest, but just kind of like the superficial aspect to it. But what about if they want to get them involved? They want to get them more involved, and it's a higher end element to it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what would you say about that?
You know,
a super hyper higher end aspect to low riding.
I feel like that takes away from what low riding was all about, to a large extent. Mm. You know, I mean, low riding was to a large extent. When I think of low riding, I think of families, I think of communities, I think of father and son working on a car. It's generational, and in some cases, it's being passed down. And the work and blood and sweat that you're pouring into it is. That car is the manifestation of that. So when you streamline that process without at least an understanding or attachment to that history, I feel like sometimes you risk doing a little bit more damage to it. What I think is interesting is that enough people have, I think, acknowledged that this type of thing is happening to where you're starting to see laws lifted. Like, for example, in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, they just lifted some of their cruising laws after, like, you're talking like 20 years of being banned.
20 years,
because they miss it, and they recognize it's such an important part of their history that it's not thriving because it's been it's basically been suppressed as a result of both policies and changing neighborhoods and also policing policies. Mm-hmm. Chicano culture in general, which consists of a lot of things, art. Let's talk about art. Look at a lot of the murals that have come down over the years in LA, for example, and just in Chicago as well. Chicago's lost a lot of their Chicano murals as a result. I mean, what do you do about that?
I think I want to bring it back though to the working class and the working poor element of the spaces where these cultural examples that you provide exist or they don't exist. Right. So it's just. So you have to envision these areas, the neighborhoods, the spaces where the cruising happens, where the murals are at. If this spatially, an area, right, blocks the streets, the working class community, and what's happening there, then so there's the cultural part, but you could have murals that someone creates today, a Chicano mural, but is in a new space where there are lofts for the middle class, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the big picture is, you know, what's happening in these communities that the people who are now living there who are middle class are reinventing what low riding is, or reinventing what the murals are and what they represent, right? So I think the class element to this is important that we need to we need to always put front and center.
And are you're saying that that's a negative thing, that the newer, that it would be reinvented? Are you saying that?
Well, I'm saying it's negative if you're pushing out the working class community, who are in large part the drivers of these murals, or even these murals depict these communities,
right?
These historically, that's a lot of these murals depict the life of working class communities. And so I think that's the really the anchor is once you start to see the gentrification shifts in these communities, I think then you start to see these changes on why the murals are gone now. Who is responsible to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Why the low-riding culture has shifted and they're being pushed out? You know, it's because of the changes of the gentrification. I think that's part of it. I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes a lot of that stuff, like the murals, for example, it's you don't get those things without having a consolidation of a community. So when you have gentrification, mm-hmm. for example, where it creates this disbursement and you start getting communities that are fragmented and mm-hmm. kind of going off into other areas. Like, I have a lot of friends who have moved out to San Bernardino, for example, because they can't afford to live in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And you see these neighborhoods splitting up. You know, you don't get that that culture, I think, in the same way that when it's fragmented as if you were when everybody's in an area and it's condensed and you have this mm-hmm. vibrant, you know, result. That's just mm-hmm, what I feel like. I don't know if there's any science behind that.
Mm-hmm.
I just...
So there's definitely a lot of elements to it when you see this. But yeah, the cultural aspect to it, again, the gentrification part, you see in a lot of places. And I in one of the assignments I have for my classes, I have them debate and read different articles on, you know, newspaper opinion pieces, and there are different takes on gentrification, and some of it includes this whole idea of gentrification and the cultural changes, and are you for it, are you against it? And a lot of my students struggle because they think, well, I think certain elements are great
mm-hmm.
because you start to see improvements in buildings and renovations and this and that, but then others will say, well, the gentrification component, some agree with it and some don't, right? But I think the big picture always has to go back and looking at the space, the neighborhood, the downtown, the surrounding areas, because that's where we see a lot of the gentrification happening. What is happening to the working class community, the people who are struggling, the renters, the people who used to wrap their lives around the tienditas, and what's happening there at the end of the day, and, you know, the mass changes that are going on. Because you could have, let's say, me open up a business there.
Mm-hmm.
Are we comfortable with that? Or am I contributing to the gentrification? So, I mean, that is a real question a lot of people are struggling with right now.
Yeah, it's tough because you want to encourage others to do their own thing as well. You know, it's like you want to support, you know, businesses from other Mexican Americans and things like that, or whatnot. Like, I want
mm-hmm.
to, but then
mm-hmm.
if you're changing or having an effect mm-hmm. on that neighborhood through that business, it creates like this moral juxtaposition that you're forced to confront.
Correct, and so that's one of the you do find some. More and more journalistic newspaper articles and online posts covering all that. And one of the things that I think about there is, let's say you do have these middle-class Latinx businesses opening up. You know, do they have a responsibility in terms of public policy to say, okay, look, we have to think about the working class community here. You know, what role do those business owners have with asking those type of questions? What role do they have in getting involved in gentrification debates or anti-gentrification campaigns when they themselves are seen or could be seen as contributors to gentrification? It's messy, but I really do think that middle-class Latinx communities, business owners have a responsibility to ask those questions.
How much of LA would you say is under the is currently undergoing aspects of gentrification?
I don't know if LA specifically, but I could give you some idea in terms of major cities and like downtown areas,
sure.
what that looks like in the United States. So, for example, in there was a report by the census that came out in 2012, and they're really looking at population change and racial population change in downtown cores of major metro areas. So, for example, like in 2011, populations of the major central cities in large metro areas grew super fast. They're like the fastest growing. So at the end of the day, what that means is like large cities in the downtown areas, population is booming. Okay. So, and you see a lot of that in the more immediate downtown areas of downtown zones. So for example, between 2000 and 2010, the area within a 2 mile radius of City Hall in 9 U.S. cities with metro areas with at least 5 million people, those areas experienced double-digit population growth, and that's more than double than the rate of these areas as a whole. Mm. So at the end of the day, the takeaway is that look at city halls of downtown areas of large cities, the largest cities in the United States, within a 2 mile radius, mm-hmm. there have been a boom of explosion of people. The explosion also has a racial spatial configuration. So that means, for example, whites had the highest population growth in the 2 mile radius of central cities. Latino population growth was mainly concentrated in pockets at the edges or just outside the edges of the central city. And African Americans increased mostly just outside central cities. Hmm. So some of us shouldn't be too surprised if we frequent these areas. That shows a different racial reconfiguration. And we know historically what central cities in the last, since the 60s, 70s, yeah. and 80s, and the 90s, right? We know working class communities.
It's like a realignment.
Working class community. Where you think about the historically, you think about white flight to the suburbs. Now you're starting to see kind of this reversal of populations, but it's not a natural reversal. And even the flight, I don't refer to it as white flight. I refer to it as white pooling. We know a lot of FHA loans for the suburb housing purchases went to white communities. We know a lot of these communities through covenants restricted communities of color. We had a lot of mechanisms in place historically for people to live in the suburbs, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a way that you attract and you create a racial configuration of where people live and live. Now we have a different mechanism. We have a reversal now coming back into the central city, but it has a particular racial element to it.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also there's a cultural element of cities are the cool place to be now. Which I think is
right.
playing a lot.
Right.
I mean, people
but a lot of that, a lot of that has to do with a lot of the infusion of policy. It doesn't just happen overnight. Oh, it's
sure.
cool because
yeah.
you have investment in the lots. You have investment in certain policies that are going to encourage particular types of businesses. And so, again, it goes back to the planning and it goes back to the policy that you create these spaces with particular visions. So it has a cool vibe. A lot of us will like it, but not a lot of us could afford it.
Right. And, you know, I'd never really thought about this till talking with you, the long-term vision of some of these planning boards,
mm-hmm.
Even though
mm-hmm.
the meetings might be about one specific project, they almost always have
mm-hmm.
a larger vision in mind that we should be aware of. I think that's really interesting. And
mm-hmm.
they don't make it easy to follow all the time what
oh,
they're
no.
doing. I went to attend some meetings once and voiced some opposition to something. And the meeting, because they had to make it available to the public to be able to attend, and they scheduled
mm-hmm.
it at the airport on the second floor, which was
oh,
just
wow.
so odd. And I'm like, that's
mm-hmm.
only, I mean, I can't think of another reason other than you're trying to not be scrutinized. Right. So they can check the board
mm-hmm,
and say, OK,
mm-hmm.
well, we're available or open to the public. But nobody, you know, most people don't have the resources to go out to the airport and go on the second floor, take time off at 2 o'clock in the middle of the afternoon and attend a meeting. So I think that's also, it's really hard for communities that are being affected probably by some of these policies. They wouldn't even probably know where to go to voice opposition a lot of times, which is probably why it's, or, you know, it's important to have organizations that can step up and speak on their behalf. But I don't know how you fix it.
Correct. Yeah. You reminded me for what we're talking about now. For the listeners, I encourage them to check out a documentary, and it's free. They could go. It's called City Rising. They could just Google that, and they'll find that. It was put on by KCET, produced it, I believe. The KCET website has that, City Rising, and it provides case studies throughout the state of California with a lot of what we're talking about, just these bigger visions, housing insecurities, gentrification, people just struggling to make it. And they really do a nice job showing you the complexity of everything that goes into the revamping of cities. And it does really bring attention to these bigger visions of what we see. And it's not just randomly happening. It's not randomly happening. Brandon, if I could, I also wanted to share why it's so hard for people to remain in these places. We talked about tenants, we talked about housing, but I wanted to mention and give you some information on just income of people. For example, in 2015, there was a study, the Pew Research Center put on some research, and they show that the median annual household income in 2015 dollars for Latino adults, Latinx adults, 16 and older, was $44,800, right? That contrasts with $61,000 among non-Hispanic white households. And they also talk about how 22% of Latinos lived in poverty compared to 9.8% of non-white Hispanic whites. Okay. Then you get into Latino immigrants. As a whole, they're economically poorer than U.S.-born Latinos generally. The Latina immigrant median annual household income was $41,000. Poverty is also a major issue. Just over 20% of Latino immigrants and 22.5% of U.S.-born Latinos live in poverty. So economically, not looking like, you know, looking at Latinos and immigrants and the white community, you start to see income disparities. And then when you think about housing and where you could live, you're not going to have that many options.
Right.
And so it's really important to really also not forget that. I mean, when you have vast differences of wealth, you have vast differences of income, and that's why gentrification should be a concern. We're having lots of disparities in income, and who's going to benefit? The middle class. And who are primarily the middle class and people who could afford it? Historically and still, whites. And so we're not surprised that we see these shifts in the downtown area, right? What I mentioned earlier, the racial configurations of where you're starting to see communities living, this all goes hand in hand. And so that's why gentrification is a big concern. There are policies that are going into effect that are encouraging gentrification. At the same time, you have folks who are trying to enact and trying to push for anti-gentrification policies. That's why it's a big concern. It's like not everybody has the wealth and income to take advantage of the beautiful new amenities.
All right.
The businesses you might have, and you do have a small percentage of people who might navigate these spaces, who might save up some money, and who might be able to afford to go there once every 4 months. That doesn't mean that the working class community is benefiting from it.
Right.
Does that make sense? You're always going to have examples of a working class collective of friends. Or, hey, let's go check that out. Let's go over there. It doesn't mean that this model of redevelopment or gentrification is really, at the end of the day, a good thing.
Araldo, with the 1 or 2 minutes we have left, what is the best way that our listeners could follow your work if they wanted to?
On Twitter, my handle is my name, Eduardo, E-R-U-A-L-D-O. And on Instagram, Eduardo G, again, E-R-U-A-L-D-O. And then I think always the easiest is you could just Google, and I'm also, I'm at Cal State Fullerton in the Department of Chicana Chicano Studies, and you could find me through there. And my email is egonzalez@fullerton.edu. And I'm always open to have discussions and exchanges with folks. I'd be more than happy to follow up. And if there's some more information that I could provide, I'm always happy and eager to do that. And I really want to thank you for the opportunity to have this discussion. I thought Kimberly provided some fantastic insights that I couldn't have provided. And I'm glad we all were able to come together today.
Yeah, we're going to have you back on to talk more at some point, because I feel like this is an issue that we could literally talk forever about, because it's so deep. There's so many different things to it. It was awesome having you and Kimberly on to share your insight. I thank you for that. I thank you for coming on to the show, and I wish both of you the best going forward with your work.
Thank you, Brandon, and keep up the great work with the podcast.
So there you have it. I feel like we just scratched the surface and probably could have kept talking for at least another hour, but all good things must come to an end. I thank each and every one of you for listening. I hope you decide to join us again next week. Until then, please continue to visit us at dailychella.com. Also, make sure to follow us on social media at dailychella. I'm Brandon Lauren Maxwell. Have a great week.